Welcome to the Full of Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 8:40 British Summer Time. Today is April 26th and today being Friday. It's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. Now, if we have a review of what's been happening this week, then the government bond markets have continued to firm and US Treasuries are up to almost 149 and German Bunds hit a new all-time high in here this week. But more generally, there is a pattern of strength right across the government bond sector, not least in Australia, which has broken a 9-10 month progression of lower rally highs. So, with equities, Wall Street continues to mostly range, and it's been up and down a great deal in the last 2 weeks, but is currently trading in the region of the all-time highs and the upper side of the range. And the Dow is finishing out the week at 14,736, and the S&P in the region of 1,585. And in Europe, which has been trading and probably has been the epicenter of risk in the last few months, we saw that there was a pretty significant bounce among the majority of equities in here this week. And they were a little bit easier at the end of the week. But there is speculation in Europe that the ECB is going to cut interest rates. And that can be viewed as positive. And in fact, José Manuel Barroso had a speech in here this week. And he began to talk about the fact that austerity is not really working. And that's really a first for the governing class within Europe. And they're starting to talk about a growth strategy. Now, over the last couple of decades, we've had reasonably impressive growth in a number of individual countries. But there's never been a concerted growth strategy. And we are starting to talk about that in here at the moment. And there's increased speculation that the ECB is going to cut interest rates. And they have room to cut interest rates, because while the Fed has got rates at about 0.25%, and the UK, I think, is about 0.5%, then the ECB is at 0.75%. And the Eurozone has contracted now the economy has contracted for the last 15 consecutive months, and investor confidence is nothing to write home about, and industrial confidence has been deteriorating, and the consumer base is moribund, and with all of that, commodity prices have been deteriorating, so that takes inflation really off the table. And since if you strip away all of the additional duties that the ECB has taken on itself in the last number of years and get right back to what its actual function is, and that is to control inflationary expectations, then there is no threat to inflation, and the need to have interest rates at this level isn't really justifiable. So if they are serious about a growth strategy, then there is the potential that we see an interest rate cut in here, and that would help to bolster confidence that the ECB is still willing to do whatever it takes. And that would suggest that there is value in a number of European companies, not least those that are leveraged to the growth of the global consumer. And what is also interesting in here, whereas last week I mentioned that Nestlé had pulled back into the region of the 200-day moving average, encountered demand, and bounced very emphatically. And I also pointed out, I think last week, that pharmaceuticals had become that bit overextended relative to the 200-day moving average and were becoming increasingly susceptible to a pullback and consolidation. Well, Pfizer is a rather interesting example this week, because it failed to get its arthritis drug approved in Europe and pulled back really quite sharply in here today and encountered demand and then bounced very emphatically from the region of the 200-day moving average. And what do Nestlé and Pfizer and Unilever have in common? Well, it's their access and their leverage to the growth of the global consumer. And it is these types of companies that people really want to own. And there was a new story in here this week that while governments are printing bonds as if they were going out of fashion, and we have negative real interest rates and yields at really risible levels, that central banks themselves are increasing their holdings of equities. And one can understand why. When the S&P 500 yields more than US treasuries, and the FTSE has got a competitive yield relative to gilts, and equities generally have competitive yields compared to their respective government bonds. And when we compare what's actually been recommended to investors from Wall Street analysts, then the average of those recommendations were that back in 1999 that you should have had 70% of your portfolio in equities. And that probably wasn't the best idea when the supply of equities was exploding with the number of IPOs that were hitting the NASDAQ. But fast forward 13 years, and they're now recommending that you should have 40% of your portfolio in equities. When, and of course the flip side of that is you should have 60% of your portfolio in bonds, when it is bonds that we're seeing a massive explosion in supply of, and that don't really represent value in this environment. So the case then for having such a low weighting in equities isn't particularly convincing. And as that realization dawns on an increasing number of people, then there will be a rotation out of bonds and into equities. And it's really only beginning at this juncture. So that the generational long process of P ratio contraction and rising dividend yields, or at least the increasingly competitive situation of dividend yields over the last 13 years, will give way to a new secular bull market. And what are the types of things that will pressure that situation? Well, rising energy prices have killed off more bull markets than just about anything. And rising interest rates are very much the same thing. So rising interest rates are definitely a threat. And there's no evidence that that is the case at present. And in fact, we can go by what central banks have been telling us, and that is that they are going to pursue inflation, and they're going to keep going until they get it. So there's no real evidence of inflation at present. And in fact, with the US missing its what analysts were expecting GDP figures to be today, and the weakness in commodity prices that's been evident right across the commodity complex for the last month, and the fact that the Eurozone remains a low growth, in fact, a recessionary type environment, and that China is moving on to a lower growth footing, not least because its GDP per capita has risen. So that raises the possibility that we're going to have lower growth and that there could be a growth scare. But in the long term, we're not going to have rising interest rates until economies such as the USA or the Eurozone return to a self-sustaining growth footing. The whole raison d'etre for quantitative easing is to avoid deflation and to put the measures in place so that growth can eventually take hold. And until that happens, then they're going to pursue a quantitative easing environment for as long as that takes. But when it does eventually give way to self-sustaining growth, then the natural situation for yields would be to rise. And as some of that liquidity is removed from the market, then that would put any kind of strategy that has been dependent on access to abundant liquidity under really quite a lot of pressure. And that could be a headwind for equities. But we're really not there just yet. And what we're really presented with at the moment is a corrective phase where the synchronicity of the market has broken down. Over the last 4 years, we've seen that risk assets have risen and fallen at the same time, and that's no longer occurring. So Europe has been the focus of this corrective phase, and Wall Street has been mostly range-bound, albeit with a mild upward bias. And a number of the Asian markets have been pulling back and have found support. And actually, a number of them, such as the Philippines, are now back to an overextended situation relative to the 200-day moving average. So we do have some short-term risks. But the big theme that is likely to animate markets for the medium to long term remains the greatest urbanization in history, the rise of the middle class, and the fact that not only is the global population likely to increase by 50% in the next 20 to 30 years, but that 3 billion new consumers will, or a greater percentage of them, will be in the disposable income bracket. And that creates massive new markets for consumer-oriented companies. And that is one of the reasons that Warren Buffett paid an all-time new high price for Heinz, and not because he's looking at what the company has done in the last 13 years, but probably more what it is going to do in the next 13 years. And it is for that reason that people are willing to wait until we see pullbacks towards the moving average, and then they're coming in with big positions, and that is seeing significant rebounds in a number of these types of companies. And we can anticipate that that is likely to continue, because the autonomies, they offer really quite an attractive cross-section, because these are types of companies that generally have competitive yields and have a global orientation and dominate their respective niches, but also have massive growth potential over not just the short term, but over the medium to long term. And they represent a really very favorable instruments to benefit from a new secular bull market in equities. And there's a great deal happening in the equity sector, and not least in China, where the government is really attempting to finally balance its promotion of the consumer sector with attempting to get property prices under control. And the banks, particularly those that are listed in Hong Kong, are trading at PEs in the region of 6 to 8, and most of them have yields in the region of 4 to 5%, and they're back in the region of their 200-day moving averages, which is where they would need to find support if the medium-term bullish outlook is to be maintained. And India, which most people have looked on over the last few years as being sclerotic and corruption-ridden, is slowly but surely getting its act together. And there were a number of reforms put past last September in the financial services sector, in removing fuel subsidies and liberalizing the retail sector. And now there's been agreement on the process that will allow land sales and land acquisitions for infrastructure projects. And in that vein, it is interesting that cement producers have held a progression of higher reaction lows since late 2008 and found support in the last 3 weeks in the region of their 200-day moving averages. And if you're going to have infrastructure development, then cement companies should do well. And the fact that they are doing well bodes well for India's infrastructure development. And since India is likely to have one of the biggest populations in the world in the next 20 years, its participation in the global economy is really a vital cog in the bullish argument for the greatest urbanization in history. And it is really quite gratifying that that is actually starting to occur. But the infrastructure development story and the rise of the middle class isn't just limited to China and India. And is increasingly becoming a factor in Africa. And of course, a good deal of population growth is anticipated to come from Africa. And here also we're seeing that the benefits of adopting a capitalist economic model and improving standards of governance is also bearing dividends, so that economic growth is coming off extraordinarily low levels, but it's world beating, and investors are beginning to look at sub-Saharan Africa as an investment destination, not just for the short term, but over the long term. And companies are devoting an increasing amount of capital to expanding in Africa. So that this is a truly global phenomenon, and it's likely to last for a considerable amount of time. Now, gold this week bounced rather emphatically, having been the headline last week for the extent of its decline. And it bounced emphatically in here, and it's unwound more than half its overextension relative to the 200-day moving average. Now, we still have extraordinarily low interest rates and negative real interest rates, so that by virtue of the fact that gold doesn't pay an interest rate, it's actually in a rather competitive environment. But something that we see at the top of every bull market is that people's interpretation and their acceptance of the bullish arguments changes, and the arguments themselves don't tend to change. Gold miners are spending more to find less. There isn't really any inflation. We've got low, any measurable inflation. If we talk about inflation, of course, in the context of a loss of purchasing power, then absolutely there is evidence of inflation. But on a central bank basis, central banks don't see inflation at present. And in fact, central banks are printing money with abandon, and that gold is immutable and can't simply be printed into existence. And those are all powerfully bullish factors for why one should hold gold. But ETF holdings of gold, which had been such a remarkable source of demand and completely unflappable until late last year, so that ETF holdings went up in 2008, even though prices pulled back sharply, holdings of ETFs actually increased during the correction. And despite the fact that gold went sideways, and often for upwards of 18 months, it didn't matter, because holdings at ETFs continued to rise. And that represented a new source of demand. And the holdings in those ETFs went from pretty much nothing to over 4,500 tons by the end of last year. And that represented one of the greatest stockpiles of gold anywhere. And what we've seen since has been that a major source of demand has turned into a major source of supply. So even though we see these stories of people queuing around the corner in India and China to buy gold, and central banks using this as an opportunity to top up their holdings, we also see that one of the largest holders of gold in the world is selling. And perhaps not enough at present to stop the short-term, the unwind of the short-term oversold condition. But a great deal of technical damage has been done. And we see this overhead top formation. So that even though we've had this impressive rally, it's not near enough to really start to indicate that demand is returning to dominance. And while we might like to see gold, if it pulls back, to find support at a progressively higher level, that would certainly help. But categorical evidence, such as a push back above the 200-day moving average and a holding above that area, would really be required to indicate that demand is back in the driver's seat beyond the very short term. And until we see that, regardless of what the bullish arguments might be, we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the fact that this is a completed top formation. And when we look at the big picture, what is happening in Japan is rather interesting. If we look at the types of things that need to happen in order for a bull market to get going, then we need liquidity. And the Bank of Japan is producing liquidity at a prodigious rate. And they're weakening their currency, which will give a competitive edge to the exporting sector. And we've had a big reaction in the stock market. Now, what Japan has had in the last 20 years is a dearth of governance. And what's happening in terms of the Bank of Japan's policy is really very positive. And it will need to be followed up by additional movement on the reform agenda. And provided that occurs, then we could be in for more than a short to medium term advance in Japan, but a medium to longer term advance. But it will be completely dependent on the improving standards of governance. And if they can come through with that, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And this week, the yen has continued to range in the region of 100 yen to the dollar. And it was stronger in here today by over a full yen and back down to 98. And the fact that the yen has weakened so much, and obviously that has affected domestic stock markets, but also it's increased the impetus of domestic Japanese to invest abroad. So what happens with the yen is likely to have an impact on other risk assets. And the fact that it is a bit stronger in here today could have a knock-on effect in Asia next week. But over the long term, what we're seeing is that fiat currencies are being printed with really abandon. And because every country is doing it, then this requires a great deal of faith in the ability of central banks to manage inflationary expectations. And it's not really a problem at present. But when we start to see that growth returns to a self-sustaining footing in Japan or in North America, in the USA or in the Eurozone, then how they remove that liquidity is going to be very interesting indeed. None of them have ever done it before, and most of what they're talking about is purely theoretical. And if they're going to avoid an inflationary outcome, then everything is going to have to be extraordinarily fine-tuned. But in the meantime, the liquidity provision that we're seeing in Japan, and seeing in Europe, and seeing in the US, is helping to stoke investor interest in risk assets. And that is likely to extend significant bull markets for at least the medium term. And obviously we'll see that some markets will become overextended, and that will be an opportunity to lighten with a view to increasing positions once more when they come back towards their 200-day moving averages. When we do see that markets return to, or economies return to, self-sustaining growth, that is going to put pressure on some of these markets. And particularly where we see that strategies have been most abundantly employed to really benefit from low interest rates. And I think it is interesting to draw a parallel between what happened between 1965 and 1980 and what's happened since 1999. Because the Dow Jones broke above the 1,000 level in 1980, and spent much of the next couple of years ranging, and valuations bottomed in 1982 and 1983. And we could see a replay of that type of scenario in the current environment. There's every likelihood that Wall Street is going to complete its valuation contraction before the end of this decade. And when it does, we'll be in a new secular bull market that could last upwards of 20 years if what has happened previously, and not just once but on a number of occasions, is any guide. And we can see already what the dominant themes are likely to be. Obviously, economic renewal will be one of them, and the fact that energy prices are likely to trend lower over that time in real terms, and that technology is likely to have a significant bearing, and not only the internet, but what we're seeing is that healthcare, nanotechnology, embedded programming are all likely to have, and industrial automation are all likely to have, significant productivity gains, particularly for the industrial sector. And consumer demand is likely to be an animating factor on a global basis. And these are very important themes, and it's really what we devote ourselves at Fuller Money to understanding and helping to raise awareness of, because what we're seeing increasing evidence of is that the autonomies in particular are exactly the types of shares that people want to own just because they offer that cross-section of both yield and growth potential. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening, and I wish all the best to all of you.